because of their religion and their thoughts that the FBI, with no proof of criminality, put two different informants and trapped them into various conversations, but still never were able to prove an agreement to do anything. These are young men who are now serving life without parole under horrendous conditions.
The hearing, the results will be given out in March?
The results should be available in March.
We're going to leave it there. Bob Boyle will continue the conversation at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Next up is the evening news.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month is Nacho Drum, showing Thursday, January 21st at 7 p.m. Released in 1993, Nacho Drum is a French documentary about the Romani people's journey from northwest India to Spain, consisting primarily of music. Again, that's Nacho Drum, Thursday, January 21st, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the EPA has released a report that neonicotinoid pesticides do indeed have an impact on bees.
Two bills to dismantle environmental regulations have passed the U.S. House.
And we'll hear a case study on the impact of Citizens United on local politics. Also, a discussion of Proposition 49 down in California.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 7th, 2016. I'm Sarika Mehta.
And I'm Robert Barncord. A KBOO volunteer has been listed as a missing person with the Multnomah County Sheriff's Department. Nathan Behensky. He's 20-something, Caucasian with short brown hair and dark blue eyes. He's about 6 feet tall, very slim. Family and friends describe him as approachable and noticeably polite. He was last seen wearing a rust-colored windbreaker, and that was on New Year's Eve, at his family home on the Willamette River, just off Highway 30 between Portland and Scappoose. Family members said that Nate got a ride home from a New Year's party and then went outside for a cigarette following a brief argument. He did not return. His phone was on for 2 hours afterward, and he left behind all of his medications. He has an EBT card, which has not been used since his disappearance. Anyone who picked up a person matching Nate's appearance on Highway 30 in the early morning of January 1st, or who recognizes Nathan, is encouraged to call either the Multnomah County Sheriff at 503-988-4300. Call Nathan's father, Michael Behensky, at 971-409-7567. Or call here at KBOO's front desk at 503-231-8032. A poster, including a picture, can be found on KBOO's website at kboo.fm.
A number of groups in Oregon that don't normally agree with each other have reached a historic agreement on what is being called the Oregon Clean Energy and Coal Transition Plan. They are pitching the results of the plan to the state legislature in hopes of turning into law during this year's short session. KABU reporter Sam Bowman has more in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
A new approach and a new timeline for state energy policy awaits the Oregon legislature for consideration. Utilities, clean energy groups, and consumer advocates have just unveiled a plan to ensure the state will be coal-free by 2030, and that the state's two largest power companies will focus on using more renewable energy and energy efficiency, making renewables half of their portfolios by 2050. Bob Jenks heads the Citizens Utility Board and says the plan keeps a 4% cost cap on any new power generated from renewables and outlines an orderly transition to cleaner power.
To me, that's a much better process where you've got a planning environment and we can sit down and say, okay, we know this transition's coming. We even know when it's coming. Let's go implement it and make that transition happen in the least cost, least risk way possible.
The plan was negotiated between these groups with Pacific Power and Portland General Electric, two utilities that together supply about 70% of the power in Oregon. The next step is to get it into bill form so it can get sponsors and be submitted to the legislature. Andy Maggie, who heads the Sierra Club in Oregon, predicts fairly smooth sailing for the proposal.
When we're starting from a place of that sort of respect and that sort of communication from groups that, you know, always don't see eye to eye, I believe that legislators are going to respond positively to that.
The push for a clean energy, clean air ballot measure in Oregon has not been abandoned, but its backers say it will be on hold while the legislature looks at the transition plan. Nick Blosser, chief petitioner for the ballot measure with the Renew Oregon campaign, thinks the coal transition plan has economic as well as clean power benefits for the state.
I think this is a good rural jobs program in some respects. You know, big things can be done when people come together and sit down at the table and talk about it.
For KABU Evening News, in collaboration with the Oregon News Service, I'm Sam Bowman.
The Environmental Protection Agency has confirmed that a widely used pesticide does indeed cause risks to honeybee populations. This comes years after the European Union banned the use of these pesticides, following numerous studies documenting a link between their use and the decline of honeybee populations. This is the first ever risk assessment released by the EPA on the long-term impact of neonicotinoids. The study focused on one class of these neonicotinoids. Their assessment found that when these pesticides are used on certain crops, pollinator hives nearby exhibit a dangerous level of chemical residue. These crops include citrus and cotton, but they do not include corn and leafy vegetables. But other studies have found links between pesticide usage on corn and the decline in honeybees. The Center for Biological Diversity said the EPA study was deeply flawed because it only analyzed the effect of the pesticides on honeybees and ignored the 4,000 or so other species of bees as well as other pollinator species, including butterflies and wasps. Despite the fact that recent studies have shown that neonicotinoids have an especially dangerous effect on wild bee populations, the EPA analysis focused exclusively on honeybees as a proxy for all pollinating insects.
Two anti-regulatory bills were approved in the House yesterday, and today along strongly bipartisan lines. The HB 1155, known as the Scrub Act, and HB 712, known as the Sunshine for Deregulatory Decrees and Settlements Act, were approved by the Republican majority en route to a likely death in the Senate and certain veto by President Obama. However, both bills represent a strong deregulatory zeitgeist on the right and have strong backing from industrial lobbyists. For more, KABU reporter Sam Bowman spoke with Amit Narang, a regulatory policy advocate with Public Citizen, a consumer watchdog group based in Washington, D.C.
Yesterday, the Scrub Act, the name for H.R. 1155, was considered in the House. Can you tell me a little bit about what happened yesterday with that?
Yeah, sure. So the House Republicans did pass the Scrub Act. This is a very dangerous, radical deregulatory proposal. frankly, one of many, unfortunately, in this Congress coming out of the House. And what it would do is essentially establish a regulatory budget the same way that we have a fiscal budget. Now, that may sound good in theory, but in practice, it would really be a disaster for public protections, public health and safety protections, and public interest regulations more broadly as well. Essentially, what would happen is that agencies would have to, before putting forward new public health and safety regulations, financial reforms, food safety protections, environmental protections, you know, the list just goes on because this would affect all regulations across the board, before agencies would be able to put out new regulations, no matter how urgent they were, urgently they were needed, how exigent the circumstances were, those agencies would have to find older regulations that were no longer needed in order to remove off of the books before putting a new one on the books. And so you could get into a very odd situation where, say, the EPA would have to take, say, a regulation on lead in gasoline, which we know has been you know, a wonderful public health success story. They may have to take that off the books in order to, for example, go ahead with the new climate change regulations. So I think even that one example will hopefully make clear to your listeners just how dangerous and problematic the Scrub Act is.
Can you talk a little bit about the makeup of who is backing this bill? Is it, like, in Congress, is it pretty much just Republicans, and private sector-wise, is it pretty much just industry? That's kind of what it seems like, but is that accurate?
That's totally accurate. So I think there's two strains of conservative support for this. One is just, you know, a kind of radical ideological opposition to government. And, of course, one of the big functions of our federal government is to implement the laws that Congress passes, and federal agencies do that through regulations predominantly. And so by stopping regulation, conservatives would accomplish quite a bit in terms of shutting down government and damaging the public interest, public health and safety across the board. In terms of business support, these folks, of course, have to spend the money to comply with regulation. So they have a clear self-interest and to a certain extent business interest in seeing you know, Washington stop regulating.
And are the backers of this bill, are they claiming any sort of benefit for the public at large and not just industry, or are they not even going there?
So what you'll hear them say is that this will benefit small businesses. Now, federal regulations do not impact small businesses directly, and even the claim that they impact small businesses indirectly is not really well supported by evidence. But it really only captures one side of the coin, of course, right? Because both all businesses, whether they're big or small, also, of course, benefit from regulations, just like they benefit from government investment in infrastructure like roads, for example. Of course, that doesn't stop them about, you know, complaining about taxes. Keeping the public safe includes keeping conditions for business activity prosperous.
All right, and that kind of brings us lastly to the bill that's being considered today, H.R. 712, the sort of oddly named Sunshine for Regulatory Decrees and Settlements Act. Can you tell me a little bit about that and how it's faring in Congress today?
Yeah, so that one also passed with almost entirely Republican support and no Democratic support. Now, this is really just one of many bills that Republicans have put out to, frankly, rig the legal system against the public interest and in favor of big business and industry. The way that it does it here is that oftentimes agencies miss rulemaking deadlines set out by Congress. Essentially, they don't get their regulations out when Congress demanded. And when that happens, in certain instances, and frankly, this is one of the best features of government, being responsive to the public, public interest groups and the public at large can come in and enforce that deadline by filing a lawsuit that basically says whatever, you know, agency X, if you've missed a rulemaking deadline, you need to give us a schedule on which you're going to get this regulation that benefits the public and benefits our public interest members out and to the public. So very simple. Of course, Republicans have painted this as an attempt by the public interest community to collude with the government and force new regulations on businesses. These are not new regulations. These are overdue regulations.
All right. I'm speaking with Amit Narang, a regulatory policy advocate with Public Citizen in Washington, D.C. Thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thank you. Hope to be back again.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
If happiness is in short supply in your life, it doesn't have to be. There's plenty of scientific research about what makes people happier, and quite a bit of it is under your control. KBOO's Demi Hellenius has more in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
To make Happy New Year a reality instead of just a pleasantry, there's scientific research that can point anyone in the direction of a happier life. Some of the tips are common sense: getting enough sleep, exercise, and outdoor time, and making time to help others. But psychology professor Tim Bono at Washington University says people who take just a few minutes a week to acknowledge the good in their lives and the things they're grateful for tend to see significant increases in their happiness.
It's also one of the easiest behaviors for us to incorporate into our daily lives. And it really doesn't even involve changing anything about our lives. Rather, it's taking just a few minutes to shift the focus of our attention to those things that are going well for us.
Bono studies happiness and teaches a 15-week course about the science behind it. He says New Year's resolutions work best when they are aimed at incorporating healthy, long-term habits into your life. And research shows that adding gratitude is one of the most effective. Bono says even curmudgeons and procrastinators have the ability to change their thinking, but it takes some willpower, and that also can be learned by practicing on little things. For instance, he says, try not checking your phone or email constantly.
If you can exercise strong willpower in those small behaviors, eventually that will accumulate to giving you the willpower to carry out the larger goals you have for yourself, like running a marathon, like eating healthier, getting more involved with the community.
Bono says people who blame their upbringing for being pessimists aren't seeing the whole picture.
About half of the variance in our overall psychological health and happiness is due to genetics, what we get from our parents, but there's also a significant part that is due to things like our circumstances and the intentional behaviors that we incorporate into our lives on a regular basis.
He adds one of the barriers to happiness is social comparison, the tendency to size up how your life measures up to others. To minimize that concern, Bono suggests limiting time on social media and connecting more often the old-fashioned way, with a good face-to-face conversation. For KBOO News, I'm Demi Hellenius.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Kathy Fung of Common Cause about the troubles facing Proposition 49 in California, which aims to direct the California legislature to tell the U.S. Congress to overturn the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling. This will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland with DJ Shay, featuring life coach Robin Bradford Joyner, and music from 8 to 10. Tomorrow's weather will be more of the same, with a high of 44, a low of 37, and a 20% chance of rain in the evening. Today in history, in 1922, the Anglo-Irish Treaty was ratified by the Assembly of the de facto Irish Republic, effectively ending the Irish War of Independence. However, the narrow margin of approval indicated disagreements over the treaty that would soon erupt into the Irish Civil War, which was won by the Republic but led to divisions in Irish society that continue to this day. The quote of the day is from Irish poet W.B. Yeats. Too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart.
It's 19 minutes after 5 o'clock and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Get ready to swallow your big statistic of the day. But first, to help you absorb the big one, here's a preliminary statistic for you. 158,000. That's the number of kindergarten teachers in America, and their combined income in 2013 was $8 billion. Now, here's your big stat of the day, even though it seems much smaller. 4. That's the number of America's highest-paid hedge fund operators whose combined income in 2013 was $10 billion. Yes, just 4 Wall Street greedmeisters hauled off $2 billion more in pay than was received by all of our kindergarten teachers. Now, which group do you think pays the lowest rate of income tax? Right, the uber-rich Wall Streeters. Incredibly, Congress, in its inscrutable wisdom, gives preferential tax treatment to the narcissistic money manipulators who do practically nothing for the common good. Even the flamboyant celebrity narcissist Donnie Trump sees through the gross inequality of this tax scam. Quote, "The hedge fund guys didn't build this country," the Donald recently barked. "These are guys that shift money around and they get lucky. The hedge fund guys are getting away with murder." Indeed, dodging through a loophole called carried interest, they pay about half the tax rate that kindergarten teachers are assessed. In effect, Wall Street's puppets in Congress let this tiny group of moneyed elites steal about $18 billion a year that they owe to the public treasury to finance the structure and workings of America itself. This is Jim Hightower saying the inequality that is presently ripping our society apart is not the result of some incomprehensible force of nature, but the direct result of collusion between financial and political elites to rig the system for the enrichment of the few, that is, themselves, and for the impoverishment of the many. There's a word for those elites, thieves.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out at hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio is raising wages for 50,000 city workers to a $15 an hour minimum by 2018. Making the announcement Wednesday, de Blasio said nothing will do more to lift up working families and move the economy forward than raising wages. So he's directing the city to add the wage increase to union contracts and agreements with nonprofit groups to deliver the wage increase to city workers. The home supply chain Menards is having employees sign arbitration agreements that may not be legal. Janet Payne, a 9-year employee from Menards in Indiana, was fired in June of 2014. She brought a federal case challenging her firing under equal employment opportunity laws. Menards sought to dismiss her claims in federal court by producing an arbitration agreement that allegedly required workers to use Menards arbitration rather than going to court. Workers had to sign the agreement to work at Menards. Marissa McDermott, Payne's Indiana attorney, says this allegedly illegal practice at Menards could be much bigger than just this one worker's case.
That is really what we see as being the major illegality here, is that we don't know how many people have signed these agreements or have read these policies and felt that they were legal and applied to them, and so they never bothered to call a lawyer. They never bothered to file a claim. They never bothered to pursue their rights because they didn't think they had any.
Unfair labor practice charges have already been filed against Menards at the National Labor Relations Board for forcing managers to sign employment agreements that threatened to cut their pay by 60% if workers they managed organized unions. OPEIU attorney Seth Goldstein says that violates labor law. McDermott says in Janet Payne's case, they discovered another document Menards managers were compelled to sign that assessed $35,000 damages against the employees if they violated any terms in the 7-page agreement. McDermott says Menards may have violated the legal rights of thousands of workers using these kinds of punitive documents.
company has instilled in their employees the idea that they can be fired for any reason or no reason at all. And it's a policy that is seen over and over again in their documentation. And that simply isn't true. You can't be fired for any reason at all. There are lots of illegal reasons for firing. But if you're an employee and believe that you can be fired for any reason, then why on earth would you ever call an attorney when you are fired?
Wisconsin-based Menards is owned by billionaire John Menard. He is a political supporter of Wisconsin anti-union Governor Scott Walker. The most trusted profession trusts Bernie. With that message, National Nurses United kicked off a national Bernie bus tour supporting Senator Bernie Sanders for president. National Nurses United Co-President Deborah Berger says Bernie Sanders best represents nurses' values of caring, compassion, and community. WIN is made possible in part by the United Steelworkers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Israeli military has killed four Palestinians near Hebron today. At Gush Et Zion checkpoint, two brothers and their cousin were killed by Israeli soldiers who were stationed at the checkpoint. And although the Israeli military claimed that the three men were armed with knives and were threatening them, no Israeli soldiers were injured. Later in that evening, a 16-year-old Palestinian boy was shot and killed at another checkpoint near Hebron. The Israeli military has come under fire in recent months for its practice of preemptively shooting at any Palestinian who it deems are threatening, including children. In addition to this, soldiers have been captured on camera on several occasions planting knives next to the bodies of unarmed Palestinian civilians who were killed by Israeli gunfire. In this case, the three young relatives were shot dead with multiple rounds by Israeli soldiers when they were near the checkpoint. They have not yet been identified, but the Israeli military has stated that all three were from Seir village, located near the checkpoint. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society reported that their ambulances and medical personnel were prevented from reaching the men by Israeli troops who blocked their access. The killing of the three men came a day after the Israeli Ministry of Defense announced that they will violently take over the Beit al-Baraka building for their further expansion of the Et Zion settlement. On Tuesday, an 18-year-old Palestinian boy was shot dead by soldiers at the same location. He was also from Seir village and was a relative of the three who were killed on Thursday.
The Syrian government has agreed to allow United Nations trucks into the town of Madaya to bring food to the residents there. The announcement came after a social media campaign this week by opponents of Syria's president, Bashar al-Assad. The campaign claimed that 40,000 civilians were starving in Madaya after the Syrian army surrounded the town. But the anti-Assad campaigners used doctored photos and videos to back their claim, several of which were picked up by the corporate media. Critics say this use of doctored photos and false testimony pokes holes in the report of thousands of starving civilians, particularly since Madaya has been a stronghold for anti-Assad forces. Many of these fighters received amnesty through a ceasefire offered by the Syrian government in late December, but some refused to leave the town. The Syrian military has been stationed in the outskirts of Madaya for the past several weeks. The town's last census, in 2010, showed a population of 10,000, many of whom left when Daesh and other right-wing fighters took over the town.
In France, a violent incident at a Paris police station punctuated the one-year anniversary of the deadly Charlie Hebdo attacks. Thursday, officers shot and killed a man who was reportedly carrying a butcher's knife and shouting, "Allahu Akbar." He was also wearing what appeared to be an explosive belt, but a bomb squad later determined that the belt was a fake. The anniversary commemorations for the 17 victims of the attacks that included four people at a Jewish supermarket and staff at a French satirical magazine occurred amid an ongoing state of emergency. The Parliament then voted overwhelmingly to extend the original order from 12 days to 3 months. Lawmakers will soon consider measures to change the Constitution while much of the public is still somewhat stunned. Khaled Sid Monhand reports from Paris.
Legislation proposed by French Prime Minister Manuel Valls calls for the stripping of French citizenship from dual national citizens convicted of terrorism. France is home to 3.5 million dual nationals, most of them from North and West Africa. The draft bill is due for parliamentary debate between the 4th and the 8th of February. Details of just how the citizenship stripping process would work remain unclear as the legislation is still in its initial stages. But legal experts like Jean-Robert Susser of the Human Rights League warn it could have profound implications for the French Constitution as written.
This measure is unacceptable. You just have to keep in mind how assembled it can represent in a country which is built of migrants. One person out of four has grandparents which were not French.
A core principle of the French Constitution is one of equality before the law for all citizens, despite differences of race, class, or religion. The sitting government now wants to amend the Constitution in order to formalize exceptional powers currently granted to the executive under the state of emergency. Judge Laurence Blisson says France already has some of the toughest anti-terror laws on the books. She worries about new powers given to the executive and the police at the expense of the judiciary.
La loi du 20 novembre 2015 vise des comportements suspects.
The law of November 20, 2015 targets suspect behaviors, and we can see with this extremely blurred criteria how a potential drift can arise, such as searching houses of people because of their beliefs, the way they practice their religion, their dress code, or what their neighbors say about them. All of those are enough to be put on a list of suspects. The state of emergency grants the executive authority the power of the judiciary. What we clearly say is the rule of law. The common law procedure is not powerless.
House raids have already begun targeting Muslims without clearly evident probable cause. Samir Weldi, a 34-year-old computer programmer, says 30 members of the SWAT team came to his home one night with their guns drawn as soon as he opened the door. He says police searched his home from 10 p.m. until 4 a.m., frightening his young daughters and leaving the house a mess.
They searched most of my hard drives and USB sticks, but they didn't touch my professional laptop. Why? If the justification for their search was terrorism, they should have searched the computer to know what's in it. I know of other stories similar to mine. Someone else who has been searched told me that he had a room full of cardboard boxes which were left untouched by the police. But his library shelves, filled with religious books, were trashed to the floor.
Wildy, whose parents are Tunisian, was born and raised in France. He wears a beard and his wife uses a traditional Islamic veil. Wildy has no criminal record and is unaware of the reasons behind the raid. He strongly suspects it was based more on his family's Islamic dress code than on a suspicion of a crime. According to the Interior Ministry, French police have conducted around 3,000 raids thus far, charging only one man with terrorism. 20 complaints have been filed against the French government because of the raids, most of them by French Muslims. The climate of Islamophobia has also intensified, including the targeting of Muslim women in traditional dress for assaults and insults. 37-year-old Hanan Mabchour says she and other French Muslim women who use a veil have experienced an increase in street harassment.
Since the last terrorist attacks, a lot of sisters are no longer leaving their homes alone. And if they cannot find someone to accompany them, they use taxis. I avoid returning home late. There was a time I used to do that, but I avoid it now. I know it sounds cliché and crazy, but I feel safe in the suburb. As soon as I see Arabs and black people, I feel relieved. When I go to downtown Paris, which isn't often, I'm afraid. I fear middle-class Parisians. I'm actually scared of white people.
In recent local elections, a formerly marginal party with a xenophobic platform made strong gains among the French electorate. 36-year-old Yasser Louati, spokesperson for the Collective Against Islamophobia, believes the current government is scapegoating Muslims for political gain.
The government is waging a war against terrorism, not to actually win it, but just to win the elections and for the president to be re-elected. We see now the state of emergency being applied. They are talking about extending the state of emergency to become an everyday thing and no longer an exceptional measure. We are talking about internment camps for people, you know, labeled as radicals. We are talking about mass surveillance, just as the Patriot Act was denounced by Edward Snowden. So all the excesses of the Patriot Act in the US are now becoming law in France. So the losers in the end are the French Muslim community first, but the whole French population as a whole.
The Collective Against Islamophobia is one of more than 100 organizations behind a petition calling on the government to leave the state of emergency and to step back from the controversial measure about the dual citizenship. The petition has so far gathered over 25,000 signatures, but a poll shows that 94% of the population supports the measure. Khaled Sid Mohand, Free Speech Radio News, Paris.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Demi Hellenius, the producer is Sam Bowman, and our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Sari Gametta.
And I'm Robert Barncord. Coming up tomorrow morning, Friday, on KBOO at 7, it'll be Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, you can hear Positively Revolting Talk Radio, on a variety of topics from an eco-feminist and anarcho-feminist perspective. At 9 on Democracy in Motion, host Lisa Loving speaks with Troutdale City Councilor Larry Morgan about the city's new coordinated campaign against sexual trafficking and other issues that the city is facing. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. And at 10:15, you'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 a.m. tomorrow, Friday, on The Digital Divide, host Rabia Yemen speaks with psychologist William A. Richards about his book, Sacred Knowledge, Psychedelics and Religious Experiences. Thank you for listening to KBOO, and thanks to all of you KBOO members for your continuing support. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. Good night, Sarga.
Good night, Robert.
Good night, Matthew.
Good night.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I'm talking with Kathy Fung. She is the state director in California for Common Cause, and we're going to talk about something called Proposition 49. Can you share with our listeners the history of this proposition, what it does, and why this is the second time there's been efforts made to get it on the ballot in California?
Sure. I should start a little bit back in 2013. After the Supreme Court came down with the Citizens United decision, and so many people around California really braced ourselves for the flood of special interest money that was going to come in and overtake our political speech, particularly as regular voters. People really wanted to act. And so in city after city, we passed voter instructions to tell our state electeds to speak up and to do what they could to overturn this horrendous Supreme Court decision. The buildup led up to a bill. This was SB 1272, authored by now Congressman Ted Lieu. And it essentially enshrined the idea in our, would have enshrined the idea in our state constitution that corporations are not mentioned in the U.S. Constitution, but that in fact the United States Constitution and the Bill of Rights are designed to protect the rights of individual human beings. And it would have asked voters if They would like to instruct our congressional members to support a U.S. constitutional amendment to affirm this notion that we the people should be primary and that the U.S. government should have the ability, when necessary, to be able to regulate entities that are artificially created by corporations.
And what became of that effort?
Well, the good news is that the legislature first passed a resolution, supported the idea, then passed the actual bill, SB 1272, and it was headed to the ballot. It should have been onto the ballot on November 2014. And then our state organization, Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, challenged the measure, saying that the legislature does not have the right to put an advisory question onto the ballot for voters to consider. And the California Supreme Court took it under consideration and thought that it was a serious enough question that they decided to remove what was that now Proposition 49 from the ballot in order to consider the question. Now the biggest issue was just that they had to consider the question, but, you know, how quickly were they going to do it? And they did, in fact, take their own sweet time. And a year and a half later, as we waited and watched, you know, opportunity after opportunity to bring this question to voters pass, finally in January of this year, as soon as everybody came back basically from holiday break, there was a decision that was issued in 2016 by the California Supreme Court saying that, yes, the legislature does have the ability to ask voters to consider an advisory question, and yes, voters should be able to vote on a ballot question to instruct their congressional members to overturn Citizens United. But the big but is that there's an outstanding question about whether, because the original bill was written in 2014 and had anticipated placing a measure on the November 2014 ballot, if the whole question was moot. And so we're now at a place where we're awaiting the court's decision on whether or not the court will be willing to place this as according to the legislature's intention and voters' hope onto the next available ballot, which would be June or November of 2016. There is an outstanding question about whether someone, whether that's a Secretary of State or the courts, can place the question before voters on an upcoming 2016 ballot. And we are eagerly anticipating that there will be a rehearing scheduled, and where we are calling upon the California Supreme Court to do the right thing, which is, you know, since they decided almost unanimously, but overwhelmingly, that voters should have the opportunity to vote on this question, that they should also restore Prop 49 to the ballot. And it's a logistical hurdle, a technical question, but it's one where, you know, somebody needs to step up and essentially accept the responsibility for issuing the authority to place it back on the ballot.
How much would you say the level of campaign spending in your state has increased since the Citizens United decision?
Yeah, there have been estimates that between money that's coming in from outside of the state, money that's coming into independent expenditures, money that's being spent on everything from candidate campaigns to ballot measures to all sorts of campaigns to support these kinds of efforts, that we're talking about hundreds of millions. In fact, actually, California in 2014 had a landmark case where some $14 million came in from out of state through a circuitous route of several nonprofits and, you know, organizations into California in order to try to influence the outcome of a particular ballot measure that had to do with whether unions could withdraw money from people's paychecks. And that money was ultimately designated by our state agency, the Fair Political Practices Commission, to be evading our disclosure laws. And we had the highest fine slapped on that dark money effort. And so fully $15 million fine was assessed on these entities that were trying to sneak it into California. Now, that's just an example of money that we knew about. The problem is that there's all sorts of directions now that this kind of secret money can be funneled through. And it is very difficult to get a handle on just how big the problem is. What we do know is that, you know, it threatens to overwhelm the voices of regular citizens. It threatens to overwhelm candidates who might be running who don't have access to that kind of special interest money. And it really threatens to undermine the notion of what we think of with the democracy, which is that each person's vote should count as one.
What's known about who funds the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, who is the plaintiff in the case against Proposition 49?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, there are a number of conservative organizations, and they receive money from a variety of sources, sometimes related to party apparatus, like Republican donors, and sometimes it's from, you know, individuals both within and outside of the state. I can't tell you specifically where they get all of their money from, but it is clear that at least with the escalation of secret money coming into California, we're seeing more and more nonprofits, so-called nonprofits, being used as funnels for money because, at least at this point, they're not required to disclose where that money is coming from. And there certainly are efforts to try to use a series of nonprofits to play a shell game where the source is not clear. While I'm not going to name any organization specifically, there certainly have been a number of those kinds of attempts to come into California. I will say, because we have a fairly strong enforcement agency in the form of the Fair Political Practices Commission, and also, frankly, we have voters who have become much more vigilant on this issue, it's something where it sends a strong signal to those organizations that try to play this game that they need to be careful, because sometimes the backlash can be harsher than you might have expected and can turn an election or an outcome around because people reject that idea of secret money coming in.